Welcome, everyone, to a new year of seminars. We are delighted, and it is also a great pleasure to welcome the Reverend Dr. Lou Mitchell, who will present our January series. He's going to tell us a lot of fascinating stories about the legendary Puritan Jonathan Edwards. Please join me in welcoming Lou Mitchell.
Thank you. Oh, wow. I hope you feel that way after. So, well, before we begin anything, let's have a prayer together. God, we thank you that all throughout history you have raised up men and women and given them special gifts for particular times in the history of the world and particularly the history of your church. Help us as we learn about this one particular saint, Jonathan Edwards, whom you gifted in so many great ways, and help us to not only learn about him and his life, but how we can be closer to you and how we can take what he taught and apply it in our lives and in the world today. All this we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Please be seated there, everybody. Okay. Lou Mitchell is my name. I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about myself. I am a native Pittsburgher. I actually grew up in Homewood, Brushton area of the city. Went to Holy Rosary Church, where I learned all kinds of things that I am happy to say I no longer kept. I forgot them. And then I moved to Wilkinsburg. I graduated from Wilkinsburg High School, went to Duquesne University, majored in music education, and then went on the staff of Young Life. I don't know if you have heard of Young Life. It's been around the area. Yeah. I went to Young Life when I was in high school. First of all, to meet girls. That was the first one. Actually, I don't want to say anything more about that. But I worked for Young Life while I was in college, and then for 5 years on their staff. This is the abridged version. Then I went on the staff of the Twin Tower Church down the road, Mount Lebanon. Back then it was called Mount Lebanon UP. And I was the director of Christian education. Doing all this, I thought, well, I better get an education if I'm gonna be involved in church work. So I started plugging away at Pittsburgh Seminary, which was where I first learned my master's degree. When I talk and preach and teach, Pittsburgh Seminary, where I first encountered Jonathan Edwards in a course that a man named John Gerstner taught. And it was basically an exegesis of one of Edwards' works called Inquiry into the Freedom of the Will. And it was an amazing course. I kept some interest in Edwards along the way. I knew of him and studied him, went off to Gordon Conwell. And then after Gordon Conwell, where I got my Master of Divinity, I entered Harvard University. And I was at Harvard for a long time. Man, I paid my student loans with highly inflated dollars because I didn't have to start paying them back for so long. I did a THM, Master of Theology at Harvard, and then I did a PhD. I was actually at Harvard 15 years, if you can believe it, not always in residence. But it was through a man by the name of Richard Niebuhr. You might have heard the Niebuhr brothers. Well, he is the son of H. Richard, who was at Yale, and the nephew of Reinhold Niebuhr, who was at Columbia. His name is actually Richard Reinhold Niebuhr. And it was Richard who introduced me to this side of Edwards that has fascinated me. And that's the side I hope we get to probably in the fourth week. The idea of beauty. Who would have thought that a Puritan and somebody named Jonathan Edwards would build his theology around the idea of God's beauty and the beauty of the world? I was struck. I was absolutely fascinated. I could have gotten a I had an easy dissertation topic because I found some old Puritan's journal, and I could have just done a critical edition of that. But that's why it took me so long to write. Am I wandering out of my range? Took me so long to finish the thing. One, because I was married, had four kids, and was working full time through all of that, mostly in ministry. I was ordained in Boston Presbyterian and had a couple churches there. Came back to Pittsburgh, was at Belfield. Do you guys know Belfield Presbyterian, Fifth Avenue? I was there in the 90s. And then after that, I spent almost two decades at an old church in Cranbury, New Jersey, near Princeton. Very historic church, goes back to 1734. Interesting thing about that, and I'll stop and get into Edwards. They have literature that says the reason why they dated 1734 is that they have a letter from Cotton Mather that mentions the church. The problem is he died in 1728. So I don't know. They never did work all that out. If you Google Jonathan Edwards, you'll see that there's several of them. There is one who is, we call him a rock star. Sing stuff, Jonathan Edwards. I will not attempt to sing any of his songs, but at least one of them would be familiar. There's also a British Olympian who holds the, I think he still holds the world record and what they call the three jumps, the hop, skip, and a jump. They call it something else now. His name is Jonathan Edwards. In fact, he may still be an Olympian. He may still be active. But the one we're going to talk about was born in 1703 and died in 1758. And we're going to see that this range of years in terms of the history of our country, this is still very much colonial America. There's some important stuff that's going to go on here that he is very much key involved in. This is one of those things like, who was the guy? This is where my age comes in. Who used to do the rest of the story? You guys know who I mean. Paul Harvey. Well, now we're going to learn the rest of the story, but this is the story that most of us know about Jonathan Edwards. And these words, listen. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. You have offended him infinitely. Infinitely more than ever a stubborn rebel did his prince. And yet 'tis nothing but his hand that holds you from falling into the fire every moment. 'Tis to be ascribed to nothing else that you did not go to hell last night. That you were suffered to awake again in this world after you closed your eyes to sleep. And there is no other reason to be given why you have not dropped into hell since you arose this morning, but that God's hand has held you up. There's no other reason to be given why you hadn't gone to hell since you have sat here in the house of God, provoking his pure eyes by your sinful, wicked manner of attending his solemn worship. There is nothing else that is to be given as a reason why you don't this very moment drop down into hell. Oh, thank goodness no book fell or anything fell. Oh, sinner, and this is the basis of it. Consider the fearful danger you're in. You hang by a slender thread with the flames of divine wrath flashing about. I'll stop there. I could go on. Name of that sermon, anybody? No, anybody? It's the most infamous sermon in American history. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. That's what it's about. God is upholding the sinner. This is, when you mention Jonathan Edwards, this is what most people know. And that's all they know. They know that Jonathan Edwards preached the most infamous sermon, July 8, 1741, in Enfield, Connecticut. That's when he did it. But that's all they know. There is so much more to the story. Whenever there, and I remember this distinctly when I was a junior in high school. Miss Pavlovsky was her name. Anna Mae Pavlovsky. Haven't thought of that name in a long time. We had to read this in an anthology. And I can just remember her shaking her head and saying, oh, those horrible, terrible Puritans. Ugh. That was my first introduction to Jonathan Edwards. I got over that one. What many people, indeed, most people don't know is something like this. This is from the introduction of George Marston's biography that you're reading. Edwards was extraordinary. George Marston is a contemporary retired American historian. He is really one of the top historians in the country, especially of religious history. He has written the definitive biography of Jonathan Edwards, and it's a big, thick one. But I guess you have it in the library, but it's checked out now. Edwards was extraordinary. Now listen to this. By many estimates, listen, he was the most acute early American philosopher and the most brilliant of all American theologians. Think about that. He has been called the greatest mind, theological and philosophical mind, that not only has colonial America, but all of American history has ever produced. Who knew? Who knew? At least three of his many works, Religious Affections, Freedom, Will, Nature, True Virtue, stand as masterpieces in the larger history of Christian literature. The appeal of his thought endures. Every year, several new books and scores of academic articles, reviews, and dissertations appear about him. Yet he also wrote effectively for popular audiences. His celebrated biography of David Brainerd, do you know that name, David Brainerd? He was a missionary to Native Americans around the time of Jonathan Edwards. In fact, he died in Jonathan Edwards' home. The town I lived in New Jersey, was where he had an Indian town for them. So the lake in town was Brainerd Lake. The cemetery behind us was Brainerd Cemetery. And it's because of David Brainerd we'll learn that many people think Princeton as the College of New Jersey was actually founded because of how Yale treated David Brainerd. We'll get to that. But his biography of David Brainerd was a bestseller in the 19th century. And it was responsible for invigorating a whole movement, the whole missionary movement, which took place. Let's see. David Brainerd, 19th century American. And he encouraged countless Christians to seek lives of disinterested sacrifice and missionary service. His writings included some of the more substantial works, continue to inspire many lay readers. He is still read today. He is read for edification. Go figure. There are courses offered on him. I taught one online for Gordon Conwell for years and years. There are dissertations written at him, a steady stream at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, many, many other places. It's a literature that, man, it takes a lot to master it, which is what one has to do if you're going to write about it. And it can appear to be daunting because he's so important in a number of different areas. First of all, Jonathan Edwards was primarily a preacher. That was his calling. He actually, we're going to find out, had the most prestigious pulpit in New England outside of Boston. He had one of the largest churches at the time, and he delivered sermons. And we have an amazing number of them. Now, one of the things about Jonathan Edwards that that one of the reasons that he was not known for a while, it wasn't really until a man named Perry Miller from Harvard. There were three M's at Harvard: Murdoch, Miller, and Morrison, who wrote about the Puritans. And in 1949, a man by the name of Perry Miller, a professor at Harvard, professor of literature, published a biography of Jonathan Edwards. And it changed everybody's perception because he wrote that Edwards was ahead of his time. And because a lot of Edwards' stuff wasn't published. But then starting in, I think it was the 1950s, Yale University Press started a project of publishing critical editions. I mean, these are scholarly works where they go back to the original text as much as they can do. And they have produced 26 volumes that are now published of Edwards' works. Number of them are sermons. Some of them are individual works. Some of them are notebooks. We're going to tell you about the notebooks and the private writings of this guy that nobody knew about because they weren't published. And it was a man named Thomas Schaefer who taught at the Presbyterian Seminary in Chicago. I forget the name of it. Man. McCormick. He taught at McCormick. Yeah. Who went and became an expert on studying paper, on studying the inks that were used at particular times, so that he could date a lot of this material. And it's only been in the last years that his stuff was made available. That's why George Marsden's biography is so important, because his is the first one that has all of that available. But you can go online at what's called the Yale Center of Jonathan Edwards. And there are 26 more volumes of unpublished Edwards works, sermons, a lot of them. A lot of them are sermons. There are some other things there. He preached. They preached three times a week. They preached in the morning, sent him home for lunch. They came back and they preached in the afternoon, not the evening because of the sunlight. And then there was the midweek lecture. And you read these things, they go on and on. I mean, an hour. Now, if your pastor preached an hour every week, you'd probably be looking for a new pastor. Yeah. I remember in early days, I remember when I had an evening service. I had a church in Quincy, Massachusetts while I was in grad school. And I had to preach morning and evening. And I'll tell you, it's exhausting to do that. But to do it for as long as they did it, and year after year, after year. So we have this enormous amount of material, most of it not published, of Edwards' sermons. The other thing about Edwards is his handwriting is very small, very hard to read. And so one of my good friends was one of the people for the Yale series. He was doing his PhD at Princeton. He helped one of the editors read some of the material. You know, you get a headache reading this stuff. And Edwards' paper was not readily available. So he's writing this stuff on laundry lists, not laundry, probably grocery lists and book lists and any kind of scrap of paper that he can get. And some of them he sewed together to make like little books. At one phase of his preaching, he had it so small that he could fit it in the palm of his hand and look like he was preaching extemporaneously. Am I still getting that? My tendency is to be right on top of you. So I think that comes from young life with kids sitting at your feet. But, you know, when I teach and even when I preach, I want to be right there with you. So he could do that. So where are we in my wandering? Okay. He was a preacher. He was a good preacher. We're going to see that imagery of what he talked about, the spider, the flames, the fire, we're going to see that he was a genius in imagery. Imagery was very important to him. We're going to learn probably some of this next week because of the way he applied, and I'm going to go to the next one. He was a philosopher, the best thinking of his day. This is influenced by the Enlightenment. He read Newton to understand science. He read John Locke to understand how people learn and know epistemology. And what he learned from Locke is that people learn through impressions on the senses. We'll talk about this. Don't worry about this first pass through. And so what Edwards believed preaching was to do is you were to help people feel, experience as much as you humanly could the reality of what you were preaching. So when he preached about hell, he preached about hell, okay? And when he preached about heaven, and heaven is a world of love, it'll knock your socks off if you read it, if you're wearing socks. He was a philosopher. And one of the things that he begins, and I'll give you little samples of this in a minute, he began a lifelong practice of writing his thoughts out. Some people I know, and my Dr. Vader, my Richard Niebuhr, the guy who guided me, was like this. He learned by writing. So whenever I would sit with him, he'd pull out a piece of paper and he would write what we were talking about. Edwards learned by writing about stuff. So he had this number of, it covers volumes, several volumes, of what we call miscellanies. Now, sometimes a miscellany could be a passage from another work that he just wanted to quote, a philosopher, a theologian, a whatever. But quite often, it's Edwards' mind reflecting on what he's writing about. We're going to see that his first entry in a smaller series that kind of begins the miscellanies, he called The Mind, is where he lays out his understanding of beauty. And then so much is built upon that. So he's a philosopher. He wrote the definitive book on on what we would call Calvinism and predestination versus free will, an inquiry into the notion of free will. The course I took with John Gerstner, that's what we read. We basically exegeted that book because of the logical way the arguments are presented. Now, you don't have to agree with it, and a lot of people don't agree with it, but a lot of people do. Let's see, what else do we want to say about it? He was a missionary. In around 1750 or so, he leaves his pastorate of many years. He's kicked out. We'll talk about that in a minute. And he goes, although he was lionized, he could have gone to Scotland, and because of the correspondence he had, he would have been lionized there. He could have gone to Virginia. He could have had major pulpits, but he went as a missionary to Native Americans in a small settlement of white folks in Stockbridge. You know where Stockbridge is? It's in the mountains, Sharon. Berkshires. That's what I was trying to. It's not near Tanglewood. And if you go to Stockbridge, I mean, and back then, that was wilderness. In fact, during the French and Indian War, they were actually in danger because they were so far away from much else of civilization. They actually quartered some troops in their house. Have you ever been to Stockbridge, any of you? You know, basically, it's one long street. And then down towards the end, there's the Red Lion Inn. I've stayed there, eaten there. And before, as you're coming into town, before you get to the Red Lion Inn, there's Rockwell Studio, Norman Rockwell Studio on that side. Well, on the other side of the street is called the Mission House. It's still there. And Edwards didn't live there, but he worked there. That was a place where the missionaries worked. Next door to the Mission House is a house, not standing anymore, where Edwards lived. And in the yard is a sundial that Edwards put there, still there. There was a time, I'm not sure what the status of this was, but he planted a tree that for many years was still standing. I don't know if it's still there. And I haven't been there for many years. And then, where are we? He's a missionary. He's an historian. This is where he rises to international acclaim, is he chronicles the revivals that are known as the Great Awakening. You folks heard of the Great Awakening? Well, he actually helps get the whole dang thing started. Although there were revivals in Eastern Pennsylvania with people like the Tennants, Gilbert Tennant and others, who, by the way, was supply preacher in my church, not while I was there, in Cranberry, New Jersey. Tennant's father, William, started a training ground for ministers called the Log College I think it's in the Chemeny, Pennsylvania, that part of Eastern Pennsylvania, almost to Bucks County, you know, over that way. Whichever way east is, let's see, that's, you know, whatever, that way. Where am I? Oh, and the Log College becomes the institutional predecessor. I'm just pausing to let that word come back into my vocabulary, of Princeton. of Princeton University and Princeton Seminary. Princeton Seminary split from Princeton University in 1812. So they are separate institutions divided by a block and a whole lot more, okay? Okay, so it's in 1734 that in Northampton, which is, we'll get to how he gets there. There's a lot of we're going to. This is just the kind of the rough go. And I have until 3 o'clock, is that right? For the four hours? I have about a half hour left, right? Okay. I forget where the heck I am. Huh? Oh, in 1734, revivals break out in his parish. And it's quite identified that that is the precursor to what happens when George Whitefield lands on the scene in 1739, 1740, where the revivals just spread throughout the colonies. In fact, the Great Awakening is the first intercolonial event. It's the most important event before the American Revolution. It's the first time all of the colonies are involved in a line of communication. The first journal in the New World, Christian History, it's called, is founded to chronicle what's going on in the revivals of the Great Awakening. It's an enormous event, and Edwards was right there in it. In fact, he's the one who writes about it in a work called A Faithful Narrative that is over in England. Isaac Watts and John Wesley read it. They want it to be published. It's a letter. It's in kind of a letter form. I'm sorry, am I out of range again? They want it to be published. And so they do. And this is what raises Edwards to international acclaim. He's the one who writes about these revivals. Even before Whitefield, he writes this in, I think, 1737. And what he does is he chronicles what happens in Northampton in his own church, where in 1 year, 300 people are added to the membership. That's huge back then. It started with his preaching on a series on justification by faith alone from the book of Romans. That's what preaching wise gets the whole thing started. Well, Edwards writes a number of very important works related to the revivals and to the Great Awakening. One of them is called Distinguishing Marks of a True Work of God. Okay, I'm going to add another piece here. Not only is he an historian, but he is a psychologist of religion experience, much like William Jennings, James, thank you very much, becomes in his varieties of religious experience. Edwards writes a book called Religious Affections, which is just that. It's one of the first analyses of what true religion is supposed to look like and doesn't look like. Because, you know, the revivals they get their critics, and there was some overdone. James Davenport was a guy who came in, was later declared non compos mentis. You know, he got everybody riled up, and they're declaring that the minister in town isn't converted. That went over real big. And stuff like that. So it had its critics. Okay. So one of the quests that Edwards has all throughout his life, once this thing gets going, what does true religion look like? what is a genuine experience of God? What does it look like? Well, in 1741, I think it is, I can check the dates. Rather than get real technical, I'll just keep spewing, if that's all right. And you can look all this stuff up, or I'll clarify. He's invited to speak at a Yale commencement. His own, we're going to see. He enters Yale at 13. 4 years later, he's the valedictorian. He stays there for 2 years and does his master's degree. Then he goes and pastors a Presbyterian church in New York City for a little while. Who knew that? Comes back to Yale as a tutor, a teacher, a professor at a very important time in Yale's. You know, he helps hold the place together, basically. All right, so where are we? So he's invited to come back. He's a son of Yale to preach at a graduation where, not long before that, the second time Whitfield comes through with the revivals, Harvard and Yale and many churches closed their doors to him. First time, they let him in, open arms. But because of some concerns and abuses of what was called enthusiasm, there's this strong reaction. And they were hoping that Edwards was going to come in and put everything right, that he was going to do it. Well, here's what he did. He gave a sermon, which was later published into a full book, called Distinguishing Marks of True Work of God. These all had long titles that went on. But Distinguishing Marks, it's known as. And what Edwards said was, look, even if all this stuff is going on, this bad stuff, too much enthusiasm, people appearing, you know, it doesn't last very long for people, so go on and on and on. He said this, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a true work of God. Okay? Well, yeah, faculty, they didn't like that at all. Because basically what he was saying was, even though there's all this crazy stuff going on, don't stand in the way, don't be caught standing in the way of a genuine work of God. And because all this stuff is going on, it doesn't mean that God isn't working in it. Well, the critics come out, and a guy by the name of Charles Chauncey, he was the pastor of the Brick Church in Boston, and they called him Old Brick. I guess he was something of an old brick. Call him an old fart, probably, is what he was. Sorry, excuse me. He is what we would call a proto-Unitarian. He is part of a group that starts in Boston and goes, who would later become Unitarians. They put a high value on intellect, and they put a high value on morality, that religion is basically morality, okay? Living according to certain principles. Well, he becomes a critic of Jonathan Edwards. So Edwards writes another book called Some Thoughts Concerning the Revival. And he addresses some of the criticisms and that the revivals have been getting. And he presents a case. What I'm going to show you is that Edwards is kind of one of the first to use Harvard Law case study method. In the first work I mentioned, A Faithful Narrative, that goes over published, he mentions two cases. A woman by the name of Abigail Hutchinson and a child by the name of Phoebe Bartlett, who is 4 years old. He presents them as cases of genuine religion. Oh, little Phoebe. Oh, what she says. It seems impossible that a four-year-old would have such commitment to God. Besides, she loved to hear Edwards preach. 3 years old, this guy. Oh, well. In some thoughts concerning the revival, he uses the experience of his wife, Sarah, but he doesn't identify her. He's gone on preaching tours at some point here. And there were always people staying in the house. That was one of the ways ministers were trained. You went and lived with another minister after you got your master's degree. Well, while Edwards is away, his wife, Sarah, has this incredible experience. Almost, it's such a spiritual experience. It's life changing. She's like almost like she's transported into the very presence of God, and it lasted and it stayed. So when Edwards gets back, he's not jealous. He sits down and he wants her to tell him all about it. This gets entered into a particular place. But what he does in some thoughts concerning the revival is he takes that, reworks it, and presents Sarah as a case for what genuine religion looks like. This is the real thing. Now, and again, they didn't know it was his wife. The reason we know it's Sarah is because we have this other document that clearly identifies it as Sarah. That's the case. Around 1740, 1741, Aaron Burr, here's a connection, senior, okay? Not the one who shot Alexander Hamilton, his dad. Aaron Burr marries a daughter of Jonathan Edwards. So Aaron Burr Jr. is Jonathan Edwards' grandson. Who knew that? Now you do. Aaron Burr Sr. becomes the second president of what becomes Princeton. He writes to Edwards. He's a pastor in Newark, I think. He wants to know about genuine religion. So Edwards writes back something that looks like it would have been written much earlier in his life, but it isn't. A work called Personal Narrative, in which he uses himself as a case study. Back when he was growing up, when he was at Yale, blah, 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 blah. All of the experience that he had, he didn't get it right away. He had real problems with the sovereignty of God. And it was an intellectual barrier for him. But what he does is he describes his religious experience in the concepts and the language of a more sophisticated, worked out theology. Follow? He takes his earlier experience and in a way translates it into what he has learned about the revivals, etc. Oh, it's a wonderful work. It's a wonderful work of how he is just hit over the head with the majesty of God and the beauty of God in creation. Man, if you want to get anything about his works, this is called a Jonathan Edwards Reader, and it's published by Yale University Press. And this has a little bit of everything in there. So if you want to get the flavor of his own language, read that. Personal Narrative is in there. So not only is Edwards an historian of the revivals, but he is an analyst of the revivals. And in 1746, he publishes, which if you're going to read one big work by Edwards, this is the one to read. It's called Religious Affections. And in essence, it's a psychology of religious experience. After defining what affections are, they're not passions, but affections are what motivate us. Okay? They're kind of internal, but it's what moves us to certain behaviors, stuff like that. So he calls this religious affections. He presents 12 signs. He says, even though these are present, doesn't mean they're a genuine work of God. Now, it's different than from distinguishing marks, where he wanted to show that even if all this stuff is present, that doesn't mean it's not a work of God. But he puts all this stuff forward about, if you even see all this stuff, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a work of God. And my gosh, the stuff he says are inconsequential. If anybody, I mean, we'd make them bishop of the Presbyterian Church if they showed that kind of religion. He said, even if passages of scripture are coming to mind, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a genuine work of God. If your behavior has changed so that, people can't believe how religious you are and all you want to do is worship God and all, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you leave in the middle of a lecture. No. No, all of this stuff, he says, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a genuine work of God. My gosh, we would so welcome people who manifested these inconclusive signs. We put them on the session right away. We wouldn't even mess with membership. I mean, it's incredible. 12 signs. Then he gives 12 signs of what do constitute a genuine work of God. We're going to discuss that work. Maybe next week, maybe the week after. So I'm not going to go any further on religious affections today. Let's talk a little bit about his biography, his life. He's born in 1703. He's in East Windsor, Connecticut, which is, I don't know if it's on or near the Connecticut River. And his father, he's born on October 5th, 1703. His father is a minister called Timothy Edwards. And Edwards is one of 11 children, and the other 10 were all women. They're all sisters. One, they were tall. So people used to refer to Timothy Edwards' 60 feet of daughters because he had 10 of them over six. Edwards was over 6 feet. I forget, 6'2", something. I don't know, something like that. He probably could have played basketball if he had been coordinated. Okay, so there is a man by the name of Richard Bushman who wrote a book or wrote an article of what we call psychohistory. It's taking principles of modern psychology and psychiatry and reading them back into history. The most classic study is Erik Erikson's book on Luther, Young Man Luther, in which he analyzes Luther's behavior. And according to his, he has like 12 or 8, I think, according to his own philosophy of learning and stuff like that, and says Luther basically never got over crisis of adolescence and hated his father. Okay, well, there you go. What Bushman does, and by the way, psychohistory is basically discredited. I mean, it's, come on, there's history, of what happened, and then reading back, and maybe it gives us some insights. You seem like you see some validity in it, huh? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. He says that Edwards was groomed for greatness. Edwards as great man, that given his place in the family, given who and what his family was, Edwards was groomed. He was going to be great. Well, that's psychohistory, and that's Bushman. At least I just mentioned that to you. Okay, let's see. There's a lot of stuff we could do. At age 13, he enters Yale. That was not unusual. 13, 14, because they were learning at home. Timothy was something of a schoolmaster, and they learned Latin and Greek, maybe even Hebrew, before they even got in to Yale. Harvard was the same way. It's quite a curriculum. In fact, when he gave his master's kind of mini dissertation at a commencement, he had to do it in Latin. He had to write it and read it in Latin. Harvard commencement, there's still a Latin address. Every commencement, they have somebody give a short address in Latin, and we all kind of shake our head, go, oh, yeah. We listen for people to laugh, and then we laugh with them. I've been to two commencements. Okay. What he does, though, how do I want to do this? I really don't have much more time, do I? 8 minutes. Let me stop right here. We didn't get much into his biography, except we picked up some stuff as we went along. Questions or comments? I want to make sure that there's always time for this. Yeah.
This fascinating man, we now have the reputation of being an angry preacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're worms.
Yeah.
Just like Calvin. Why do we have that impression of him?
For one, he did preach it. But we haven't read the rest of what he preaches. Well, I'm going to show you. I don't have it with me. They all preached that way back then. The uniqueness of Edwards. Well, I'm actually going to read a section. I do this. I set a class up. And I read this section about spiders and all that stuff from a sermon. And it turns out I'm quoting Charles Chauncey, the proto-academic Unitarian. They all preach. The reason why we remember Edwards is the power of his rhetoric, the power of his use of language. He is a genius. This is one of, and he does it for a particular reason. He, based on John Locke's epistemology of how we learn and know something that he discovered while he was at Yale, he wants to make an impression upon people in that moment. So that's the power. Oh, the sermon, the excellency of Christ, the beauty of Christ, it'll make you weep. Yeah.
Where was the repository of this, the physical stuff he could hold of his works? I'm fascinated.
Trevor Newton had a little bit of it, but mainly at Yale, at the Beinecke Library. That's where it was. And if you're going to do Edwards research, you had to go to Beinecke. And this thing by Schaefer, this guy I told you about, dated everything. Before, they had a hard time getting him to let go of it and publish it. But with his permission, you could go to Yale and read his manuscript there. Couldn't take it out, but you could read it there. Yeah.
I thought I'd add a comment to confirm yours, not that they need to be confirmed. When I was living in New Haven 20 years, a graduate student, I belonged to the church in which Jonathan Edwards was buried, in the basement. And
he's at Princeton. Okay. Go ahead, tell me though.
Maybe there's a memorial part, but we would invite people to come to speak. And inevitably, they would reference Edwards And the interesting thing is there were several people who refused to come because they felt that he was such a gold standard. I mean, that would be our term today. Yeah. And they just didn't know if they could come up to that sort of fire and brimstone.
Sure.
But I, and of course, as a young person, I was a quote baby then, I didn't really appreciate it. So I'm really glad you're offering these comments today.
Good. Edwards dies shortly after he becomes the third president of Princeton. And he's buried in Princeton. I've been there many, I mean, I lived near Princeton for almost 20 years. So, okay. She's a New Haven girl. We met online, and she almost wouldn't contact me because she worked for Yale, and I had a Harvard sweatshirt on in one of the pictures that I had. And friends had to convince her that it might be worth her while to check me out. Yeah. Homewood to Harvard. How's that, huh? Not bad. That should make a good article someday. Yeah. Questions, comments?
States.
Ancestry?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know all that much about it, frankly. There is something about that somewhere in there, it's not very good. I think you said something, a grandfather on the other side.
Is his genealogy.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you one thing about, Jonathan Edwards' grandfather, his mother's father, his mother was a Mather, you know, Cotton Mather and all that. It's all these minister family stuff. Was the most powerful minister outside of Boston. They called him Pope. His name was Solomon Stoddard. Just a little piece of history, how it goes and the roles these play, and we'll end with this. Going back to 1630, when Massachusetts Bay was founded, to be a member of the church required quite a lot. Not only did you have to talk about your conversion experience, not only did you have to talk about, like we would call, the fruit of the Spirit and how you're living afterwards, but you had to give detailed account on the steps by which God led you to faith. We call this preparationism, okay? Do you know Anne Hutchison? Do you know that name? Okay, well, it may work with him. Anyway, the second generation wasn't, I mean, they didn't come over on the ships and they couldn't give that kind of recitation of their experience, and so they couldn't join the church. So the problem is, what do you do with their children, the third generation? If they're not members of the church, you can't baptize them, right? Well, in 1660, they have this kind of convention or synod, and they come up with what they called the halfway covenant. And that was this. If you were baptized, second generation, but weren't a member, you could present your children for baptism. And it would just perpetuate. They would still have to give an account, blah, 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 blah. Well, Solomon Stoddard, Edward's grandfather, said, He said, I'm not going to deny them the Lord's table, communion. They couldn't take communion. They weren't members. Because he said he thought that having communion was what he called a converting ordinance. It was part of the steps that God used to prepare you for faith. Well, he was in big controversy with the Mathers and all the Boston people, but this is what Edwards inherited. Because he follows his grandfather in Northampton. Grandfather dies after Edwards is his associate. I'm sorry, I didn't get all the biography stuff. I don't know if it's important or not. Edwards inherits this. But later on, he starts thinking, I think I agree with the earlier Puritans, you know? And so he tries to reinitiate the halfway covenant, okay? You follow? Where you can present for baptism, but you couldn't come to the Lord's table. And what one writer said was, a Bushman maybe did this one too. He said, they used to be Puritans, but they became Yankees. It's what it is, from Puritan to Yankee. And they weren't going to have it. And it was over that and some other thing, the bad book incident that Edwards greatly mishandled, that they kicked him out. That was reason they weren't going to go back. Questions, comments? It's past time. Go get them. We'll be back next week. You're welcome.